Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ben Sachs. I'm counsel for actually the law firm of Leventhal, Brown & Piuga, but we won't be dividing up the argument as between Leventhal, Brown & Piuga and the Lammers. So I'm going to handle that. I'm going to start with a little bit out of order compared with the briefing and focus on the denial of the motion for leave to amend under Rule 15A and then go backwards, if that's okay, with the court's indulgence. As the court knows, the denial of a motion to amend shall be under Rule 15A freely given if justice requires. And the motion for leave to amend came after there had already been a compromise and settlement with three of the defendants, two doctors and Deborah Hayes. So there was a motion for leave to amend to add a claim of negligent credentialing against the hospital. And the elements of a claim for negligent credentialing under Colorado law have recently been set forth in the Settle versus Basinger case. There are essentially four elements, and as the court set forth in that case, there's a duty on the part of the hospital, there's a breach, there is an injury to the plaintiff, and there's a sufficient causal connection between the alleged negligent conduct and the injury. And the proposed amended complaint clearly met all of the elements of a claim, a tort claim against the hospital for negligent credentialing of a health provider. Now, in spite of that, the trial court found that the proposed amended complaint against the hospital was futile. And so I'm going to start with the issue on futility.
Was that the only reason that the court denied the motion?
Our understanding, our reading of the order is that that was the principal reason for the court's denial. It looks like the court may have also rested in part on an alternative ground of delay. But as far as we can discern, those were the only two reasons that the court gave for denial. But first I'm going to focus on the futility of amendment. This court has held repeatedly that an amendment is futile if it could not withstand a motion to dismiss. And that is a test that is akin to a 12B test for sufficiency, for legal sufficiency of a complaint. So normally the court is only required to look at the four corners of the complaint, draw all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-moving party, and determine whether or not the claim, as pled, if accepted as true, states a legally sufficient claim. And for the reasons I mentioned before, applying the elements of negligent credentialing to the complaint makes it clear that had the court just simply applied that test of futility, 12B test, you know, does this complaint withstand a motion to dismiss, it should have passed it and found that it was non-futile. But instead, the court did something unusual. It did not follow the settled approach under 12B. It did not accept the facts that were pled in the proposed amendment as true. It did not confine its review just to the four corners of the complaint. But instead, at the invitation of the hospital, it went outside and looked at an affidavit that had been submitted and, you know, essentially weighed that affidavit against the allegations of the complaint, which had rested on sworn deposition testimony of Dr. Hayes, that at no time had she ever been through a credentialing process at the Children's Hospital. And the court essentially found that that fact was, you know, supported by an affidavit was somehow preclusive. And we would submit that that was an erroneous process and an erroneous decision.
Mr. Sachs,
yes, sir.
Did counsel object to that procedure at all in the district court?
Yes, actually, we did object to that procedure in the district court. We objected repeatedly to that procedure, and specifically with regard to the affidavit. It wasn't just the affidavit, it was a supporting document. that was appended to the affidavit. We pointed out that we actually recited to the court the futility standard that we believed was applicable. But we also pointed out that if the court is going to consider extrinsic facts and documents and go outside the pleadings, then essentially that's converting it to a summary judgment proceeding, which would be premature, entirely premature, because we hadn't completed discovery against the hospital at all. So what we argued before the district judge was that he should not be considering that extrinsic information at all. But we didn't stop there. We also said that, you know, you shouldn't be considering this extrinsic information that's submitted under seal. That they asked the court to look at an exhibit that was sealed. The court agreed to seal it and withheld it from the plaintiff. And it was sealed purportedly on the basis of a CPRA or peer review privilege. But what we contended was that if they rest on the privilege, that means it can't be considered at all. But if they want to use it as a sword, then under the sword shield analogy that this court has followed and the Supreme Court has followed, that they impliedly waive any privilege by putting it into evidence and relying on it. And the court still refused to let us even have access to the exhibit, know what it said, and argue on the basis of that document that we were still entitled to proceed on a claim of negligent credentialing. So our contention is that the court erred in both the manner in which it decided the motion for leave to amend and in its decision. Now, as Your Honor pointed out, there also was perhaps a separate alternative basis, which was delay. And the case law that we cited establishes that delay is only a pertinent factor for denial of leave to amend if it is prejudicial. And what we submitted to the court was that first of all, a close examination of the chain of events that had gone on in the trial court revealed the reasons for why events moved at the pace and in the sequence that they did. It wasn't until relatively late, in February of, I think, 2012, when there were case central depositions of the doctors and of Deborah Hayes, which essentially pierced the pleadings and got at the actual facts that were in dispute. And then there was a motion to amend that came on the heels of that with reasonable promise. That's our contention. But so our argument was, even if there were factually a basis for arguing or for finding delay, mere delay isn't an adequate basis for denial of a motion for leave to amend. That's an abuse of discretion unless the delay is an undue delay that results in some prejudice to the party that will then subsequently have to defend against the complaint. So, and further, just simply having to litigate a meritorious claim is not the sort of prejudice that warrants denial of leave to amend. So our contention is that for all these reasons, the court should have allowed the amendment, and had the court allowed the amendment, it would have necessarily vacated the order of dismissal. There would be a still existing meritorious claim against the hospital to litigate. But that's not all. So now I'm going to go back. If you don't have any specific questions further for me on that, I'm going to go back further. And I think I'll move back to the initiating motion to dismiss. And the original motion to dismiss was made by the Children's Hospital. It came after there had already been an answer on behalf of Deborah Hayes and two surgeons. And it was predicated on Rule 12b-5. And it challenged the complaint on a number of grounds.
Mr. Sachs, I'd like to focus on a couple of things because our time is running short. Specifically, I'm concerned about this captain of the ship argument that you're making on appeal. The reason being, I don't see it having been made anywhere in the trial court. In fact, in your opposition to the motion to dismiss, and I'm going to quote, You said, quote, "Plaintiffs are not seeking to hold TCH liable for acts and omissions of the other defendants which constitute professional negligence," period, end quote. And in fact, there is no mention at all in that response to the captain of the ship doctrine. And then in later on, when you sought to amend and you moved to reconsider, there is one mention of the captain of the ship doctrine, and that is that it doesn't apply to the doctors because they never should have allowed Ms. Hayes to be in the operating room, and that was it. But on appeal, you're taking a very different position.
All right.
How can you do that?
Fair enough. Here's the answer. It has to be understood in the context of the history of this litigation. When the complaint was first filed, and it was filed on behalf of Cody Wynacott, who is both mentally and physically disabled and incapable of providing a great deal of factual information. Based on our investigation of the case, we were under the impression that Deborah Hayes was an employee or agent of TCH. And if you read that, the initial complaint and the amended complaint, which was filed after the appointment of the Lammers as guardians for Cody Wynacott, it continued to allege that Deborah Hayes was an agent or employee of TCH. So the reference I think that you may be making to the original argument was at a time when it was believed that the other defendants were the surgeons and that there was vicarious liability of the hospital for Dr. Hayes, who had in fact previously been an employee of the Children's Hospital, but unbeknownst to the plaintiff and their guardians, had later become a faculty appointment at the Children's Hospital.
But Mr. Sachs...
Oh, I'm sorry, at the University Hospital.
But Mr. Sachs, the response says that you are not seeking to hold the Children's Hospital liable for Dr. Hayes' professional negligence. That's what it says. And now you say on appeal, yes, we are.
Well, I think that maybe the statement you're singling out, I mean, I'm just trying to conceive of, because my recollection, quite honestly, Judge, is different, because as I recall, there were some arguments about captain of the ship that were included, but...
Not mentioned. Words did not come up in your response.
But,
and in fact, the motion to dismiss had characterized the complaint as alleging that Dr. Hayes had performed all of her work that was being complained about during the surgery. There was no contest to that in your response. And the only allegations about Dr. Hayes in the response were about these issues relating to who should have disclosed what about liability coverage. There wasn't a thing in there about captain of the ship doctrine. There wasn't a thing in there about actions she may have done during the surgery. And then you come on appeal and it's all about something you didn't even mention in the opposition.
Well, I think that my apologies if that's what the record establishes.
Well, I don't need apologies. I need some authority for why we can even consider your argument.
I think that there was a motion for reconsideration that also focused on the captain of the ship doctrine.
And like I said, it didn't mention this argument at all. It wasn't even focused on Dr. Hayes. It was focused on the other doctors, and it was one sentence a year later.
Well,
after the dismissal.
My understanding, well, I see that I'm running short on time, but all I can say is I believe that it was based on a misapprehension, a misunderstanding of Dr. Hayes' status and her role in the chain of events that led to Cody Wynacott's injuries. And, I do think that the thrust of the response was that there can be vicarious liability against the hospital for both the acts of non-physicians and also for the non-medical actions of hospital personnel. So that was the thrust. I guess I'll just continue. There was also a contention in the complaint that it fell under the independent acts of negligence or special conduct exception to the corporate practice of medicine doctrine. So I do believe that was the thrust of the response, And there is actually...
You can finish your sentence.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, the response on the corporate tax event, or I got flustered because of the time. The response on the cabinet ship is that that is very fact specific. It depends on whether or not the events in question took place during the surgery, but also whether or not there was an actual agency that existed. The complaint did plead an agency, and we believe that it pled a legally sufficient claim. The corporate, the defense is simply a defense that the hospital may rely on, it may not rely on, as to the claim of vicarious liability, not a direct liability claim. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
I'm going to jump right into the captain of the ship. I have the exact same quote.
Excuse me, counsel.
Yes.
Could you identify yourself for the record as well?
Sure. My apologies. Tracy Van Pelt, with me is Matthew Miller. I represent Children's Hospital. Your Honor, I have the exact same quote in my outline about the captain of the ship issue. And clearly, anyone who reads the First Amendment complaint, there were 145 numbered paragraphs, only one related to a claim of vicarious liability. All of the others related to this issue of disclosure of insurance and the unfairness and essence of the Governmental Immunity Act cap and the hospital's responsibility to inform patients that the physicians and providers there were covered by the Governmental Immunity Cap. There are a couple of issues. One is respondeat superior, which is a claim they're now raising both through the motion for reconsideration and the motion to amend. It is now undisputed and established Dr. Hayes was not a children's employee ever during this time period. The plaintiffs have conceded that in response to the motion to amend, or in reply to the motion to amend. They acknowledge she was an employee of the University of Colorado. There is no respondeat superior claim. She was not our employee. With respect to the captain of the ship, it was completely, utterly ignored in response to our motion to dismiss. You're absolutely right. It wasn't mentioned. And they went further, saying we're not seeking to hold the hospital responsible for the professional negligence of any of the providers. Our direct negligence claims relate to this insurance and disclosure issue related to insurance. Procedurally, this case is a little bit confusing to me. The plaintiffs are asking that the First Amendment complaint be reinstated, which does not contain a claim for failure to credential. And they're also asking the Second Amendment complaint be allowed, which does not contain a claim for respondeat superior liability. So I'm not sure exactly which complaint they want to be the operative complaint, but I think these need to be addressed separately. Turning first,
Ms. Van Pelt, may I ask you a question about the captain of the ship doctrine?
Yes.
Is it not correct, however, that the court itself relied upon the captain of the ship doctrine as one of the bases for denying, for granting the motion to dismiss and denying the motion to reconsider?
Correct. We raised the captain of the ship as a defense to liability for Dr. Hayes, and set forth in our briefing the captain of the ship doctrine and the basis for it. Every single allegation in the complaint related to negligent conduct starts with the words during the surgery. Every single allegation. So our argument was, even if you were to find she's our employee, which she's not, even if you were to find she's our agent, which she's not, the captain of the ship doctrine eliminates liability for the hospital. She becomes like the agent of the surgeons during the surgery and thereby carries the liable.
Right, but what I was trying to get to was what Judge Jones was asking of Mr. Sachs related to the waiver issue. If in fact they did not specifically raise that issue in their response or in their motion for reconsideration, do you believe that precludes us from reviewing it if, in fact, the court relied upon it as a basis for denying the, or for granting the motion to dismiss and denying the motion to reconsider?
If I'm understanding your question, can this court consider the specific control issue that's being raised for the first time on appeal here? I think no. They never raised the argument they're making with respect to captain of the ship. They're making here in this court below. The trial court relied on the captain of the ship in a completely different argument, that these two surgeons were performing surgery. She was alleged to be assisting them in the performance of the surgery, and well into surgery, an event went wrong. Captain of the ship means the hospital cannot be liable for her actions, the physicians are. What they've alleged on appeal is that was a mistaken ruling by the court, because now there's a factual dispute as to who controlled Dr. Hayes' conduct during the surgery. That issue was never raised below. That they basically didn't respond to the captain of the ship argument below at all in any briefing submitted. So I don't think this court can consider their new argument about control during the operating room because it was never raised below. But because they're also alleging as part of their appeal here, denial of the motion to reconsideration related to this respondeat superior argument, I feel compelled to address in part this captain of the ship argument, because it simply eliminates any liability for Dr. Hayes' conduct, her professional negligence, whether they cited to any particular factual dispute or not. So I do think the law on the captain of the ship is clear. I also think it can't be argued any further that she was an employee of Children's Hospital. That has been established, it's been conceded in the pleadings. Dr. Hayes denied she was an employee in her answer. She testified she was not an employee at deposition. This is all in the record. The plaintiffs conceded in reply to the motion to amend she was not our employee. So there's simply no employee-employer relationship that would give rise to any respondeat superior liability. And on any kind of an agency theory, captain of the ship eliminates liability. They did claim in paragraph 144 a negligent hiring claim, and I think that was part of the hook for this motion to reconsider. We didn't hire her. So as the Villalpando court says, if you don't hire somebody, you can't not hire them negligently. So I think that claim simply doesn't survive review, and the trial court agreed. Because they have raised the issue of control, which I don't think this court should consider, I do think if the court's inclined to, the case law on captain of the ship is very, very clear about this. The Ochoa case, which is cited in our brief, states, in the absence of evidence negating the physician's right to control, there is a presumption that the surgeon is in charge. They never alleged anywhere in the first amended complaint or the second amended complaint the physician did not have right to control. So not only is there no evidence negating right to control, it's not even alleged. So I think the captain of the ship doctrine simply eliminates any potential liability for Children's for Dr. Hayes's negligent conduct during the procedure. I want to turn now to the credentialing issue. On the motion to amend, they raised for the first time, it's not negligent credentialing, because that claim is not permitted under the Counts case. It's failure to credential. That's their claim, and that's the only claim they can bring. So I think we need to be really clear about that. The hospital is immune from liability under the Peer Review Act and the Counts decision if credentialing occurred. Period. That's the end of the case. That I think is indisputable. So the only question is whether she was credentialed or not.
But how can the trial court consider these materials outside of the proposed amended complaint in determining whether to allow the amended complaint?
Here's why and how. The Peer Review Act says the credentialing file is not discoverable, it's not admissible, it's not subject to subpoena. It can never be a fact question whether credentialing occurred. We cannot, it's not a testamentary, testimonial privilege that says unless the client consents, the privilege is intact. This is a legislative mandate The peer review file is confidential, period. For public policy reasons, it can't be looked at by anybody.
But that may go, I guess what I'm concerned about is the timing. So what the question is, why can that material be considered on a motion to amend? Now, maybe later you can come up with a motion for summary judgment, but why at that stage can it be considered?
Because what we did in response to the motion to amend was say this failure to credential claim is futile. Why is it futile? Because she was credentialed.
But don't we ordinarily look to see whether it's futile by just looking at the allegations of the proposed amendment? That's my point.
Correct, but the only way to decide whether that claim has merit is for the court to look at the file in camera. That's the only possible way to comply with the Peer Review Act's mandate of confidentiality and defeat a claim of failure to credential.
Well, is the issue of whether the claim has merit and defeating it the properly a subject of the motion that was before the court at that time?
I think it was, because we argued that if we established, if credentialing occurred, she can't file a failure to credential claim. And there's no such thing as a negligent credentialing claim under the Counts case and the Peer Review Act. So there is no way, if we credentialed her, they have a viable claim. And there is no way to establish credentialing occurred other than to submit it to the court for in-camera review, which they did not oppose. That was an unopposed motion to submit under seal. They requested we provide a privilege log, which we did. The plaintiffs never opposed submission of the credentialing file to the trial court.
Do you agree with them that they opposed the court relying upon it and ruling on the issue?
They raised this shield and sword issue, which is a puzzle to me, because there's simply no way to defeat a failure to credential claim if they're correct. That I can't waive the privilege. It's not a waivable privilege.
Well, there's a way to defeat it. They're just got to do it the right time. I mean, it seems to me motion to amend gets granted. You can file a motion for summary judgment at any time under the rules. So you file your motion and you submit your documents under seal, and there you go. I mean, what we're concerned about here is the timing of things.
So if I'm understanding you, that the court looked at the credentialing file under Rule 12 context versus a Rule 56 context?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, not just a Rule 12 context, but a motion to amend context. Not a dismissal, a motion to amend.
Right.
Okay, would you typically, I mean, at least what I'm used to, is you look at the complaint, if it states the elements, I mean, putting all aside timing and all the delay and all that stuff, but it states the elements, okay, the amendments allowed. You may have defenses to that, but you don't assert the defenses in opposing the motion to amend unless those defenses are apparent from the face of the complaint.
Well, it becomes a little bit more problematic, I think, because in the first amended complaint, they actually alleged Dr. Hayes was privileged to perform these procedures, and Dr. Hayes admitted that in her answer. So that particular allegation was not included in the second amended complaint, but it is part of the record with respect to the first amended complaint and her answer. She admitted in her answer that allegation that she was privileged to perform these intraoperative monitoring services.
When you say privileged, you mean that's the equivalent of credentialing?
It is. The credentialing process is what you go through to get privileged to perform a particular procedure in the hospital. The words are essentially interchangeable. And so I think what you're struggling with is that on a Rule 12 or futility argument, the court looked at the credentialing file, and I guess the procedural posture should have been we don't oppose the motion to amend and immediately file a Rule 12 converted to a Rule 56. The point here is she was credentialed. The claim can't stand as a matter of law. You have the credentialing file. You've seen it. It's in the record for the court to review indisputably what she was credentialed. That's the end of her case, period. I mean, the plaintiff's case is over if we credentialed her under the laws that existed at this time. So whether there was a procedurally different way to do it, should it affect the outcome here? I mean, the truth is in the file, in the court's possession. So I do think they raised for the first time on appeal this argument that we didn't apply, that it sounds to me like they've almost conceded that we did in fact credential her, and the new argument is, well, our credentialing process didn't quite comply with HIPAA, the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act. That's nowhere argued below. Again, that's a new argument raised for the first time on appeal. We submitted Dr. Matthew's affidavit. It lays out the process. The credentialing file itself identifies the process. I don't think the court can even consider that argument on appeal that's raised for the first time. I want to address just briefly the delay issue, because I think that there's an important timing factor with respect to that. The trial court's delay issue was not the delay between Dr. Hayes' deposition and the filing of the motion to amend, although that was a component. There were 4 months there. We were out of the case in April of 2011. They didn't take any discovery until February of the following year. None. And the court had issued a delay reduction order in November saying, I'm not moving the trial date. You guys are under an obligation to litigate this case going forward. They never sought discovery of Children's Hospital ever through a 30B6 deposition or otherwise. They didn't take the deposition of Dr. Hayes, and there's no claim that there was any difficulty in scheduling her deposition. Both of those, if they want to hold the Children's Hospital vicariously liable for Dr. Hayes' conduct, they could have investigated that much sooner than they did and filed a motion to amend much sooner than they did. And that delay in conducting the case is, I think, what the court was focused on in finding undue delay in the motion to amend.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted. And we'll proceed to the second argument.
With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
We'll see how it goes.
I agree. I just have 5 points to make. This is with regard to the issue of the court's interpretation of two statutes and its application to the facts of this case. The court below made an unprecedented, broad, and expansive construction of these two statutes that are at issue here. And we're asking the court to reverse the trial court, applying de novo review. The court should find first that this is a matter of first impression in the appellate courts. There are two decisions of the Court of Appeals that have touched on the issue, but both of those are distinguishable because the issues that are being raised in this proceeding were not raised in any other case. In one case, there was an appeal, but it wasn't an appeal by the law firm or the lawyer who had been charged with fees and costs, so it was a question of standing. In the other case, the attorney was the spouse of the party and didn't contest the issue. So this is a case of first impression. The defendant, the hospital, has not pointed to any case law in Colorado that's controlling or otherwise on the precise question of interpretation that's before the court. Secondly, and this is a point that we think was not really addressed adequately in the answer brief of the hospital, but this court has found that the statutes in question are in derogation of the common law. They're in derogation of the American rule. The American rule clearly and unequivocally establishes that normally parties bear their own legal expenses and they bear their own legal fees, except under certain circumstances, when it's provided by statute, where it's provided by rule, where it's provided by contract.
So, counsel, I have a question about that. It was something that I think might have been brought up in the answer brief, but I thought it was interesting that in 1317.101,
yes,
the legislative declaration, the last sentence, it says that all courts shall liberally construe provisions of this article to effectuate substantial justice and comply with the intent set forth in this section. What do we do with that? There are these cases talking about we should strictly construe because in derogation of the common law, but let's assume that principle ordinarily holds. Can't the legislature override that? Because they're entitled to change the common law. So why can't they say, we want this statute liberally construed, not strictly construed, and haven't they done that?
Well, first of all, I agree with you. Of course the court can abrogate or modify the common law. They can abrogate or modify the American rule. if they choose to do so. The Supreme Court, however, in the Robbins case and other cases, said that when they choose to do that, they have to act with unmistakable clarity so that it is abundantly clear to litigants and courts alike that that's, in fact, their intention. So, but that's not all. One of the unarticulated premises of your question, I believe, is can 1317.101 and the following statutes be read and construed in pari materia with 1317.201? And I think that the answer to that is no. They are two separate and distinct and independent statutory schemes enacted at different times, and they don't refer to one another.
But the legislative declaration says this article. So it's not this section, it's Article 17, and 201 is part of Article 17.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about the legislative history, because it's in the context of that that you can understand whether or not the legislature had that in mind. The court addressed some of the legislative history in a case called Hudak versus Mobil Oil Corporation, 879 P. 2nd, 417. It was a 1994 Court of Appeals case. And they point out that 1317.201 is more specific as applies only to tort actions, which are dismissed pursuant to Rule 12b. 1317.201 was enacted in 1987, and this statutory scheme was a 1984 enactment, and they cite later in time than 1317.102, which was enacted in 1977. So I think that the prerequisites to engrafting a provision that's in 1317.101 onto 1317.201 simply don't exist here. That it was not within the contemplation of the legislature when it enacted that provision that they were referring to a body of statutes that allow fee shifting under specified circumstances when the court found that there was substantially frivolous, substantially groundless, and substantially vexatious litigation. And of course, the court here didn't make any findings related to the application of 1317.101. It completely rested its decision on 1317.201 and said that was controlling. So,
well, I'm a little confused because you say that 1317.101 and the following can't be read together with 201, but then I understood one of your arguments on appeal to be that the court had to consider the factors in 103 in assessing attorney fees under 201. So which way is it?
Well, I think the answer is that they're not to be read in pari materia, and they were enacted at different times for different purposes. One had a more narrow and specific purpose, one had a broader purpose, and they shouldn't be read together. But if they are read together, then essentially this court would have to question the holding rationale in the Hudak case and say, well, what happens if, you know, a party or an attorney charged with fees wants to avoid a fee liability or cost liability on the basis that they're raising a question that is novel, that is substantial, material, but for which there is no clear precedent, it's not clearly established law.
But I think the case law on that is clear. If you lose in these circumstances, an award of fees is mandatory.
Right.
And 201.
Well, but the argument that you're referring to, I think, is the argument that there are exceptions to fee shifting under 1317.101 under specified circumstances.
No, actually, my question was more about the reasonableness of the amount. I mean, one of your arguments on appeal is that the court didn't consider those factors in 103 determining that. But didn't I hear you say today that, well, that statute, 101, 102, 103, those shouldn't be read with 201?
I think that the court in its case law has unequivocally established a body of precedent dealing with determining fee reasonableness, starting with a lodestar analysis, much of which is borrowed from federal civil rights law under 42 U.S.C. section 1988. One of the principles of which is you don't charge your adversary with fees that you don't charge your own client. You know, which.
Well, so I just want to make sure I understand your argument then. Are you saying that a party may defend against an award at all of attorney fees under 201 by considering whether the arguments asserted were frivolous. I mean, it seems to me that the case law just says if you lose in these circumstances, an award is mandatory. And maybe the factors that you're talking about relate to the amount, but not the awardability.
It's a possibility. I think that the court reviews an award under 1317.201 as to the amount for reasonableness and takes into account a multitude of different factors based on the case law. I think I'd have to agree with you that if it's mandatory fee shifting, those factors would be applicable to determining it the reasonable amount.
Okay. Now another question about 201. As I understand your argument that it can't be awarded against the law firm, it's because the statute doesn't mention an award to a law firm or against counsel. But the problem I have with that is it doesn't mention any part. It doesn't say against whom the judgment should be entered. And so following that logic, there couldn't be an award against anybody because nobody specifically mentioned it.
Well, I think that the answer to that is simple. I mean, it refers to the entry of judgment. A judgment is something that, absent specific provision otherwise, can only be entered against the party. Silence does not allow this court or the lower court to just engage in a wide-ranging, listing of non-parties who may be subject to a fee award. If the legislature had intended that a non-litigant might either have to share liability or have to have liability in lieu of a party, it easily could have said so and surely would have. So the type of construction that you're referring to and which the hospital is advocating is something that would require this court to read additional words and phrases into 1317.201 and to engraft provisions onto a statute where the legislature didn't adopt those provisions. So, our contention is that would be a mistake of law.
I think I understand your argument that judgments can only be entered against parties unless the statute says otherwise. Okay. Who is here today to represent the plaintiffs? I mean, I would assume the plaintiffs themselves have no problem with this result. They're not being tagged with attorney fees at all, and yet their law firm is in court arguing that they should be. That seems to me to be a conflict of interest.
Well, in order to really assiduously avoid any potential conflict, Mr. Bjorst entered an appearance and is appearing in this proceeding on behalf of our clients, the Lammers, and they're still our clients.
But he signed off on a brief arguing that they should be tagged with attorney fees. That sounds problematic. I mean, the argument is, nope, only the client, not the attorney.
No, actually, that wasn't his position. And there's been no cross appeal in this case saying, oh, this judgment should now be reformed and revised and applied against the Lammers in a way that would expand the indebtedness and the obligations of the parties.
Well, if we reverse, if we accept your argument in reverse, that's not the end of it. It goes back to the trial court to award attorney fees against the plaintiffs.
Well,
that's the result.
I don't think that that's the necessary remedy.
What would be the remedy?
I think that the remedy is that the judgment charging fees against Leventhal Brown Puga is reversed.
Right. And
period.
But that's it. But an award of fees is mandatory. There has to be a judgment against somebody under 201.
Well, I suppose that if there had been an issue raised in this appeal, a cross appeal raising that issue and saying, well, if you should find that the assessment of fees against Leventhal Brown Puga was erroneous, then at least charge the plaintiffs. But there has been no such argument here.
Well,
the only part
has they won. I mean, they don't have any reason to cross appeal. They got an award of attorney fees.
Well, against Leventhal Brown Puga.
Yeah, anyway. And I'm sure as far as they're concerned, that's perfectly fine.
Well, it's not perfectly fine because they,
I'm sure the hospital thinks it is.
Well, I suppose
so. Your client does.
In any case, I would disagree with you as to whether or not what you refer to as the remedy here is either a necessary or a proper remedy. There was never a request in the trial court to assess fees under against 11th Brown & Fuga under 1317-201. It was a request to assess fees under a completely different statute, and it was a request to assess fees against a party, against Cody Winecott through his co-guardians, which normally would only be something that could potentially be collected against Cody Winecott's estate, because the guardians themselves are immune from liability for any expenses of their ward. So the point here is that what the court did was it sua sponte, on its own, rejected the statutory basis that was proffered by the hospital, and it rejected the alleged liable party that was proffered by the hospital. In their prayer for relief in their motion, they singularly asked for fees against a party. They were not seeking fees against any non-party law firm or attorney, either in lieu of or in addition to a party. So that was something that the court did on its own. And frankly, our contention is that it erred in doing it. So the other thing I wanted to point out, it's really the last point, is that the adoption of this, our construction is in no way absurd or unjust, but the adoption of a new rule that would expand liability to plaintiff's attorneys, and not just the plaintiffs, would itself not only be an unprecedented expansion, but it could have untoward consequences in terms of the ability of people to secure legal representation to advance novel, meritorious, but perhaps not clearly established law. That should be reserved to the legislature and not the courts, with respect.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs.
Again, Tracy Van Pelt on behalf of Children's Hospital. With respect to this appeal, I think this issue is a matter of very simple, straightforward statutory construction. I don't think you even get to the legislative history in this case. The last statutory scheme needs to be read together. I cannot imagine, again, I have the same quote in my outline, a more clear statement of legislative intent. All courts shall liberally construe the provisions of this article to effectuate substantial justice and comply with the intent set forth. I don't think you can get a more clear statement of legislative intent that this scheme is to be applied as a whole as broadly as possible.
Counsel, what about the contention that it was the district court that came up with the award of under 201 on its own, and then on its own, again, without request, awarded fees against the law firm rather than the client?
That's actually not correct in the record, Your Honor. We filed a motion for fees under 201 because the original complaint was dismissed on a Rule 12 motion. Again, I think this is an important point. There were 145 paragraphs in that complaint. 144 of them related to this issue of governmental immunity and insurance. That was the fourth time the Leventhal firm had filed that identical complaint, and the fourth time it was dismissed under Rule 12. Four times. So as between a client and a lawyer who continues to file a lawsuit dismissed under Rule 12, where's the substantial justice? It's in awarding fees against the law firm, not the cognitively impaired individual. In reply to our motion under 201, we asked that fees be awarded against the Leventhal firm.
In the reply.
And in response to that, they filed a motion saying their disabled client was the only party fees could be awarded against. That briefing was submitted, I think, the night before our argument, the evidentiary hearing on the amount of attorney's fees. So we asked that it be awarded against the Leventhal firm. And in response, the Leventhal firm filed a brief saying the only award can be against Cody Winecott, who's a cognitively impaired paraplegic. And I think, understandably, the court took a little umbrage at that position. And you raised the conflict issue. I think that was precisely a problem for the trial court in part two. The court's order is crystal clear. As compared to a cognitively impaired client and a law firm who's filed the same complaint four times, who should be liable for the attorney's fees.
But we are dealing with a statute that has particular language, and it does say a judgment. Okay, typically, as counsel points out, we think of judgments as being entered against parties, not against the law firms.
But I think if you read the statutory scheme as a whole, that's a more stringent construction than is necessary. 101 says this broad legislative intent to discourage groundless, baseless litigation. 102 says if it's groundless, baseless, you can award it against the lawyer or the client. 201 is simply a subset of a groundless, baseless piece of litigation that's even more egregious because they can't survive a Rule 12 motion. So to argue, I think it flips the entire scheme on its head to say you file a complaint that can't survive a Rule 12 motion and your client's the only one on the hook, but if you file a complaint that's baseless or groundless after some discovery under 102, you can be liable. That makes no sense. And I think that the only way to read that statutory scheme together is that you have 101 saying apply it broadly, 102 saying apply it to any frivolous, baseless claims. 201 is even narrower that says this is a subset of those frivolous claims and you don't even have discretion. You have to award attorney's fees.
Well, you characterize 201 as dealing with frivolousness, but that's not how I read it. It's just motions to dismiss under 12B, which could be a lot of things. Could be jurisdiction, could be failure of service, could be all kinds of things. Because it says 12B, it doesn't say it's just 12B5. So even if a complaint is dismissed at the 12B5 stage, it doesn't mean it's frivolous.
Well, I think it does mean it's groundless in the law. There's no legal basis for the claim. So frivolous may not be, frivolous may be an overstatement. I think groundless or baseless are the two buzzwords that matter here that are in the statute. And I think the Kristowiak, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, case actually talks about Rule 12 dismissals and 201 being an even more, and I think they use the word egregious, example of a case that is groundless or baseless. And the award of attorney's fees there is mandatory. So I think under these circumstances, the court properly interpreted the statutory scheme as a whole and applied it as against the party to further the goals of substantial justice here, that the entity that knew whether the claim had legs or not.
But here, as has been pointed out, this statute 201 was enacted 3 years after the other statute, 103. Actually, 103 may have been as old as 1977. But and in that statute, of course, the General Assembly did mention law firms or attorneys, and didn't in the later statute. I mean, that would have been easy if it had intended to allow awards against attorneys. They had done it in the past, just a few years earlier.
But I think what they're essentially asking is for this court to read silence to mean clients only. And I don't think that's a fair reading of the silence of Section 201. I think that the reading that fits with the overall scheme is apply it broadly. It applies against lawyers and clients, and 201 is a subset of baseless claims. I don't think they have to add the language of lawyers or clients. You raise the point of if it's silent, then who's it awardable against? And I think that's exactly the issue. Under their interpretation, it would be nobody.
Well, Mr. Sachs did respond to it. It's judgment. You have to look at the word judgment. And as I said before, we typically think of judgments as being awarded against parties.
But I don't think so necessarily in the fee context. For example, Rule 37 sanctions a fee award. That can be awarded against a law firm, and a judgment for those fees can be entered against the law firm. I think that happens all the time, actually. That there are means by which courts can impose judgments against lawyers even when they're not parties. That's part of the court's supervisory power, and the legislature is instructing you to apply that really broadly when it comes to these kinds of claims. And I think the Counts case, which is also the failure to credential case, has a clear statement of how to interpret statutes and the statutory scheme as a whole. And 102 says that fees may be awarded against the lawyer or the party, and Section 201 says you have to. So I think 201 is narrower, and it's a subset of 102. 102 says you may if you think the claim is baseless or groundless, and 201 says if it's subject to Rule 12, it is, and you have to award fees. And it is the Kristowiak case at 90 P. 3rd, page 869. And I think that's where the court, the Supreme Court actually comments on a Rule 12 dismissal and 201 being a more egregious, baseless, groundless finding than you would find under 102. So I think if you construe those together, which you have to, Section 201 says it's so baseless it can't survive Rule 12, and I don't see how you could read that statute together and find only the clients if it's dismissed by Rule 12, but if it's dismissed under some other baseless or groundless finding, it's both the client and the lawyer.
What about this issue of the amount and what factors the court can consider? It's difficult for me to tell from the record what factors the court did consider in reaching the amount, because the court, at least the second go-around, deemed the objection to reasonableness withdrawn merely because of the withdrawal of the request for a hearing.
Right.
So there are no reasons stated as to reasonableness there, and as of the first go-around, it wasn't clear to me either. It seemed to me the court was rejecting the factors in 103. Kind of categorically saying, well, 103 just doesn't apply here, but don't some of those factors have to apply?
I don't know that they're specifically under, this may be one point that Mr. Saxon and I agree on, that 103 are the factors. I think there are common law factors related to an award of fees, but regardless, with the first motion to dismiss, we had a half-day hearing on the reasonableness of the attorney's case with expert testimony. The plaintiff hired a lawyer to opine on the reasonableness of our fees. I took the witness stand and testified about the work we had done. So the court did a thorough amount investigation applying the factors the court should apply to determine what a reasonable fee award would have been.
I don't think there's a question necessarily about the sufficiency of the evidence. It's mm-hmm. more of the sufficiency of the findings issue. We can't tell from the record what factors the court considered in deciding whether the evidence supported the conclusion that the fees requested were reasonable.
Well, I think the first fee order actually does address the hourly rate, the amount of time expended, that there were novel issues raised in this, because remember the first Rule 12 motion related to the interplay of the Healthcare Availability Act, the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, insurance requirements, negligent misrepresentation related to public employee status. Those were issues, and it was stated in the fee hearing that the plaintiffs were intending to appeal that portion of their complaint. So we devoted substantial resources to making a very good appellate record on this Governmental Immunity Act and Healthcare Availability Act interplay, and that's not the subject of the appeal. So I think the court did look at the complexity of the issues, the amount of controversy, and if I'm recalling correctly, cited there was something of $1 to $2 million claimed against Children's. I think they left off a zero. I think it was 10 to 20, actually. They looked at the experience of counsel, and those issues, I think, are identified in the court's order on attorney's fees, and then the court addressed against whom the fee award should be awarded. With respect to the second set of motions, I do think if you waive an evidentiary hearing, you waive your right to contest the reasonableness of the fees.
I was going to ask you about that, because I'm not aware of any case law that says that. I know that you certainly waive your right to a hearing if you say, unless you request it.
Correct.
But it's one step further to say where you have objected to the reasonableness of the fees, that when you don't request a hearing or when you withdraw your request, you've therefore waived your objection to reasonableness.
Well, I think the corollary is, in our motion for fees, we submitted affidavits, these were reasonable, and here's what the fees were based upon. Their obligation to challenge that is to provide some evidence they're unreasonable. And if you waive your hearing and you produce no evidence on the reasonableness of fees, I think you've waived arguing they're unreasonable. They have the burden of establishing the fees were unreasonable by evidence. And waiving an evidentiary hearing, I think, is the roundabout way of waiving any argument to the reasonableness, because it's simply they have no evidence in the record those fees weren't reasonable. And finally, I just want to address the issue of fees that were paid versus billed. I think the cases that say pro se, lawyers who are representing clients pro se can recover their fees under Section 201, that's I think there's no clear prohibition against a trial court awarding the fees that billed to a client, regardless of, for whatever reason, if the client didn't pay them all. Are there any other questions? Because I think I've covered the topics I needed to cover on that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Case will stand submitted.